Thank you. Good evening, everyone. As Joa mentioned, tomorrow is the anniversary of Maizumi Roshi's death. Someone is saying we can't copy that link in the chat. So we'll have to figure out some other way to send it. If you're interested, I guess, send an email to Wildflower and we'll send it to you. I don't know. You guys can think about that while I'm talking. And Maizumi Roshi, so here's a picture of him, just so you have an idea of who he is. There's also a picture on our website of him. I never personally met him. I had planned to go to Los Angeles with my teacher to meet him. And I don't remember why, but we decided to put off the trip and put it off till the next year. And the next year he died. So I did not go to see him. However, I feel that he is very present with me and with us. As Joa said, we would not be here if it were not for him. He came to the U.S. For the first time in the late 1950s, I think probably before I was born. And came just really to cater to the Japanese community in California. There was a big Japanese community. And they had a need for teachers to perform rituals, basically, weddings, jukais, funerals, just to maintain a temple where the Japanese community could go through their religious rituals. There was no sitting practice whatsoever. And so Maizumi Roshi was sent to do that, to assist other teachers, other priests doing that. And then he would, if a Roshi or a sensei of some kind were coming through the US, he would welcome them and assist them in whatever they were doing in the US. And he was doing that. He was helping Yasutani Roshi, who was also a famous Roshi in the West, in Japan and then in the West, at a small retreat, a weekend retreat. And that's where he met Bernie Glassman in Los Angeles. And I think this was in 1963. And because Bernie was at that retreat. And Bernie tells the story that Maizumi was just a monk who was helping this teacher. And at some point, Bernie asked the teacher why they practiced walking meditation. What was the point of Kin Hin? And the teacher said, oh, go ask my assistant, the monk. So Bernie went and asked the monk and said, why do we do walking meditation? And Maizumi's response was, when we walk, we just walk. And this really struck Bernie, the simplicity and the directness of this teaching, of this statement, when we walk, we just walk. A few years later, Maizumi came, or I forget exactly how it happened, but Maizumi led a retreat himself, and Bernie went to it, because Yasutani was no longer coming back from Japan to the US. And he became his student. And together they created the Zen Center of Los Angeles in 1967. And Maizumi Roshi then went on to have 12 successors and create two large centers, the one in the mountains and the one in Los Angeles, have hundreds, thousands of students throughout the world. And his students, his successors then went on to have hundreds of students throughout the world, thousands of students throughout the world, centers, practice centers, temples, everywhere in the world, on every continent. But in the beginning, when he first came, Mizumi Roshi, it was none of that. He was no one. In fact, he worked as a gardener because he had needed to earn his living somehow, and he didn't speak English. But he knew how to garden from growing up in a temple situation. His father was a Roshi and the head of a temple. And in Japan, that's how it works. It runs in families. And so he knew how to take care of gardens, and so he was a gardener. And there are pictures of him from those days when he's a very young man in a t-shirt, jeans, just working in the garden. Nobody, no one special. A man of no rank, as we say. And from that, he was able to respond to the context in which he was, to the people who came to see him, to, without any expectations or fears or attachment to a plan or a position. He just went, he just responded to what arose and to the people who came to see him. And look what, look where we are today. We would not be sitting here without him. Since the talk last week, I've been thinking of this word that came up, entangle. And when I realized a few days ago that it was Mizumi Roshi's, the 25th anniversary of his passing, suddenly I started seeing this word. I had already been really involved with sitting with the word and having things develop from it. And then it kind of snowballed when I started thinking about and sitting with Mizumi Roshi as well. So some of you were here last week, others weren't, and unfortunately the talk was not recorded, so you can't go back and listen to what we said about the word entangle. Or maybe you could, because it was Joa who brought it up in a question or in a comment, so it would be on the recording, because that part was recorded, if it was recorded at that point. But the way that we were referring to it last week was being, you know, entangled as being caught up in something, ensnared by something, caught in a difficult situation or with difficult emotion or something complicated, something, I don't remember exactly what the context was, but it was that definition of the word. But actually, and this, I knew there was something when I heard that word last week and I heard our discussion about it. I realized there was something in it that was bothering me, or that there was something else in it for me. And I went and looked up the word in the dictionary. And actually, the first definition of entangle, before you get to those other definitions that I gave, is to wrap or twist together. It's to interweave, to intertwine, to interlace. It's about relationship. It doesn't say anything about being complicated, twisted, troubling, nothing like that. The first definition is what I just said. And I was thinking, that's it. That's what was troubling me. It's not that the other definitions we were using are not correct. It's just a different definition and a different usage. So I really like this first definition, however. Because what this practice is about and what Mizumi Roshi's entire teaching was about is his teaching, basically, as the title of his book that I just showed you is appreciate your life. So appreciate your life as the life of the Buddha. Appreciate your life as the true treasury of the Dharma eye, as we say. your life as it is appreciated. But in order to do that, we have to become entangled with our life fully, wholeheartedly, holding nothing back. Maizumi Roshi's word was to be intimate with. So, or he would say, close the gap between yourself and yourself. That's what it is to be entangled. To be infinite with, to be engaged with, to engage and entangle with yourself, with your life, just as it is. Now, of course, this also means being entangled and engaged with whatever arises. And the example that I've been using is my example of being sick. So I allowed myself to become fully entangled and engaged with that, not holding back, and not seeing it like the other definitions of the word entangled. For me, it was to be fully engaged with whatever is. We can think of it as, often we think of it as the other. So become entangled with whatever other is present, presents itself. The other can be myself. The other can be sickness. The other can be an emotion. The other can be another person, a situation, whatever it is. And it's not enough to see it. It's not enough to say, oh, okay, I see I'm sick, or I see. That's not enough. You have to be it. You have to fully engage, fully entangle, be entangled with it. So I find myself pausing and seeing what comes up. And when I first started teaching, I did that, I think, more than I do now. I think I should do it more, actually. Instead of trying to just keep talking, I think I should pause more and return to what I used to do. But when I was just a very young teacher, so starting out, people who knew Maizumi Roshi would tell me that he did that a lot. And that when I would stop and pause like that, that reminded them of when they would hear him talk. And someone said that him doing that had the effect of offering the people who were listening, students, an opportunity to merge with his presence in a way, to become entangled with his presence in a way that they wouldn't with just constant flow of words. Because when we're listening to words, we're using our head to take it in, to make sense of it, we're judging it, we're trying to understand. Sometimes we're even like we're filtering in and out, and we're saying, oh, I don't agree with that, or I do agree with that, or that sounds stupid, or that's confusing, or we're offering all kinds of commentaries about it. Whereas with the silence, we might also be doing that. We might be uncomfortable. We might be saying, why is she not talking? What's going on here? But if we let ourselves just be with it, then I liked this when I heard someone say this, that people could merge with his presence and with the Dharma in a different way in that silence. part of the reason that that's possible is because that's what he was doing too. That's what I'm doing when I'm sitting here and not saying anything. I'm just waiting to see what arises. I'm becoming entangled with what arises. Taking a step back, pausing, looking in the other direction, looking down. And feeling what's there. And that's the ancient way of Zen. That's the way that has been passed down to us from Maizumi Roshi and through 80 generations before that. So that's the way now, and was the way then. That's always the way. Just this, as it is right now. And when we can fully entangle with it, then we come back to what we've been talking about for 2 weeks now, love. When we're intimate with it, with ourselves, with whatever arises, that's where love is. That's where we become entangled with love as well. And I keep using this word with, which would seem to be dualistic. Me with something, or me with someone. Well, the truth is that what we call awakening is only possible in relationship. Relationship with yourself, relationship with another, relationship with whatever arises. Because if we don't see the multiplicity, the diversity, we're missing half of reality. This is why we have a teacher. This is why we say that the transmission is transmitted from one mind, heart to another. In the Zen tradition, that awakening in relationship is the key. And that comes back to what Roshi said to me, as I told you. Well, that's what transmission is about, love. That's it. That's what it is. And it happens in relationship. And this means that, so when we say to be entangled with whatever arises, it means that you meet and care about wholeheartedly whatever it is, holding nothing back entirely. Whatever the circumstances. So Maizumi Roshi comes to America, works as a gardener, engages and entangles completely with the Japanese community. And then when stray Californians start coming to the temple and wanting to sit, he sits with them. And then when there become too many to sit in that temple, they find another place where they can sit together. And he responds. He gives himself entirely to that situation. He becomes entangled with them. He becomes intimate with them and with the situation. And that, I'm thinking about the lineage that Maizumi Roshi created, what we call the White Plum lineage, is known for being one of the most eclectic and creative lineages in the West. No two of the teachers are alike, and no two of the teachers, not only, of course, personally are not alike, but the forms and the way that they teach, none of them are the same. Some are radically different from what they learned in ZCLA with their teacher, Maizumi Roshi, which was quite strict, traditional Japanese monastic practice. He was Japanese, that's what he knew. But his successors, for the most part, diverged from that. Not from the essence, not from the essence of your life is the life of the Buddha. You are it. Love is it. They didn't diverge from that. But how they manifested it, the way, the forms that they used when they became entangled in their circumstances with people who came to see them in their cities, in their lives, are vastly different, all of them. And I include myself in that. And I'm fortunate, I feel very fortunate to have received that teaching and been in this lineage, because I would have been lost without it. I struggled so much when I came to Portugal and had nothing. I was like Maizumi Roshi coming there to a new country. I didn't speak the language. I didn't know anyone. I didn't know what to do. I tried to do what my teacher did, and it was a terrible failure. And I say a terrible failure. I think the people who were there in those days would not say it was a terrible failure, but I'm grateful for them for sticking around, for still being around. But it wasn't appropriate. I was trying to reproduce the same forms I had received from my teacher, and it was not appropriate for the situation. So I threw everything away, like Maizumi Roshi did, and just responded to what came. And here we are now. It was one of the greatest lessons I've ever received was that failure. And I was able to respond to it because I received that transmission in this lineage. Now, Maizumi Roshi, apparently, I also heard this from Bernie Glassman, he encouraged his successors to find their own way and their own forms. He didn't want them to be limited to what they had received from him. And that's exactly what I just said about my own teacher. Part of the, when you receive transmission, and part of this in the ceremony, there's the teacher who's giving the transmission, takes a vow to support the successor in however they need to be supported, in whatever way they choose to go. The teacher has total confidence and will support them. And Bernie always said that Maizumi lived up to that vow. He didn't like what Bernie was doing. He didn't like that he was making cookies and brownies and building centers for the homeless people and calling that Zen. But he trusted entirely Bernie. He trusted entirely the transmission and trusted entirely Bernie that was what Bernie thought was the way. However, Maizumi Roshi died quite young. He was only 64 when he died, which by our standards today is, even at the time, was very young. And his successors and successors of successors and students of successors were all very distraught about this. But Bernie also used to say that he thought Maizumi Roshi, not that he wanted to die, but that he was ready, because he felt that he had done what he needed to do. He had brought this practice and these teachings to the West. He had implanted them firmly. He had 12 successors who were going off on their own and finding their ways in unimaginable directions. And that he knew that in order for Zen to flourish in the West, it wasn't going to be with someone like him. It was not going to be with a Japanese person. It was not going to be with the traditional forms. And he had to get out of the way to let his successors fully embody it. This is Bernie's interpretation after the fact. But I'm assuming that he knew Maizumi quite well, and probably they had discussions about this. Not that Maizumi Roshi should die to get out of the way, but that was what needed to happen. It's the same thing with parents and children. At some point, you have to get out of the way and let your child develop. And even, you know, I've heard elderly people say, it's not our time now. We have to let go. It's the younger people's time. And so in that sense, some of Bernie's successors felt suddenly free. Bernie himself, that's when he took off his robes, let his hair grew a beard. Until that time, he shaved his head. He still wore his robes. He wore the casual monk's wear clothing that monks wear when they're not in their formal robes. Even though what he was doing was not at all traditional. The teachings he was doing and the forms he was using were not traditional. He respected his teacher and he respected his monk's vows and maintained them. After his teacher died, I don't know if it was right away, he disrobed and we know what he became. All of this to say that Maizumi Roshi was able to do that because he became entangled with his students and their circumstances. He knew it intimately, and he could therefore let go. He knew that that's what he had to do, was to let go, to let them entangle with their circumstances. It seems like a contradiction that we would say become entangled, if we think of the other definitions, you know, to be caught, to be ensnared, to be trapped, maybe. But actually, when we talk about liberation in this practice, about being free, because we say vast is the robe of liberation. You've heard me say this is a path of liberation. This is a practice of liberation. It's not about being free from the world, free from the circumstances. It's about being free in it. In the world, completely, fully in the world. I can't remember where it was. I looked for it even today. I was looking for it to be able to find the quote, but somewhere I read Maizumi Roshi say, talking about the bodhisattva path, the bodhisattva being the archetype, the Buddhist hero archetype, who forgoes his own or her own enlightenment to help others become free. Because the Bodhisattva realizes that that is his enlightenment. His awakening is in that relationship. But Maizumi Roshi used to say, the Bodhisattva accepts completely to go into the mud, to go into what we call the dust of the worldly world, to go into the relative world. And the Bodhisattva accepts completely there to get fully dirty, full of the mud, to become fully entangled with it. Because that is where we are. That is to be fully engaged with where we are. You know, we chant at the end of the Orioki chant, we say, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. So lotus flowers bloom in the mud. And that's exactly this too. So when we say, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus, it's not about being free from the mud, it's about being free in the mud. To be pure. Pure, not as opposed to dirty, but pure as the sense of being entirely that. Nothing left out, nothing held back. To really, to love the muck, the mud. To love the dirt, to love it all. Because that's you, that's who you are, that's who we are. And in Maizumi Roshi's statement to us, encouraging us to appreciate our lives. In order to appreciate your life, you have to experience it, right? And you experience it by becoming, as I said, fully engaged and entangled with it. And then you realize that you already have everything you need. And that this life is your treasure. And that you are free to use that life to respond fully to whatever arises. And you have everything you need to do that. It's an infinitely creative experience. You don't need anything else. You don't need any other materials. You don't need any other, you don't need any special paper. You know, I've been doing a lot of writing and I decided to start doing some drawing too because when I was sick in bed and whatever. And I just had my ordinary notebook and my ordinary pencil. But I didn't let myself be stopped by that. I know they're not the kind of drawings I would do if I had really nice paper and a whole set of nice pencils, but it doesn't matter. I was fully engaged in it, fully entangled with that moment. Free in that moment. Creative. I cared about it. I fully met that moment with all the sickness and the difficulty and the doubt and the worry and the fear and whatever it was. And I loved it all. I love it all. Maybe I'll stop there and let you a few questions or comments if you would like to.
Hello.
Hello, Luis.
Good to see you. I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about once you mentioned, I think your master, your teacher was when you were having a child, and she said, go in the direction of the pain.
Yeah.
Just being entangled is in that direction.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Thank you for reminding us of that. You have to unmute, Debbie.
I was wondering when I don't know if everybody else knows what you were talking about. I know I don't. When you were saying that you went to Portugal and it was a flop, do you mind saying what flop?
When what? When I went to Portugal and what?
You went to Portugal and it didn't work out at all.
Right. Yeah, well, just briefly, I was invited to go to Portugal with Roshi was invited and she took me with her because she didn't want to go and establish a sangha there. And so she said, if you want someone to come back, it will be Amy. And so they invited me back. It was someone who organized the Buddhist group in Porto. And so she said, you okay? This was in October. And she said, you want to come back in April? And I said, yes, okay. And she said, what do you want to do? And so I suggested just what I had always done in Montreuil, which was a weekend session. And residential session. You know, I didn't know anything else. So she said, okay. And we did that. And, you know, there were some people. I don't think there were a lot of people. Nobody knew who I was or anything, but she was very good at organizing and getting people to come to things. And they came. And then she invited me to come back a few months later and we did the same thing, but it wasn't the same people who came back. And we did this a couple of times. And we didn't have any cushions. Nobody knew any of the forms. So every time I had to teach everything all over again. I was wearing my robe and my rakusu and everything, but nobody else was. I think they had a cushion for me and maybe for someone else, but otherwise it was like, you know, rolled up blankets from the room and pillows from the couch. And we didn't have anything, you know. And no way to do orioki. The woman who invited me was the cook. And it never, we did this a few times, but I think the last time we did it, there were maybe seven people or something. And it didn't make sense. I said, this is ridiculous, you know, doing all of this, organizing this whole residential thing for people who don't know anything about the practice and don't know any of the rituals. And it doesn't mean anything to them what we're doing, you know? So I considered quitting, you know, I considered quitting teaching altogether at that point. It wasn't happening in France either, you know. I think it was Joe and Delphine and me, and I don't even know who else, and the people who aren't around anymore. And I considered quitting. But And my teacher said, okay, do whatever you want to do. Gyanpo said, do whatever you want to do. If you don't want to teach, don't, you know. But I had a moment where I decided not to quit, but to just start over. Throw everything away. No forms, no robe. I wore my rakusu. That was it. And we decided to just have days of practice. So I would go to Portugal. I would go to Lisbon and give a conference, a talk at the Buddhist Union. And then I would go to Porto, and on Saturday we would do a day of practice, basically an introduction day. And on Sunday we would do an introduction day. And lots of people came to those introduction days. It was a response to the situation as it was. People, they didn't know anything. They were interested. They wanted to learn. We showed them. And we did that. I don't know how long, maybe a year and a half. We did those things. And by this point, there were people who were coming back. And we started then. At that point, we decided to do a summer retreat. And for a week, it was a big step. We decided to take the plunge. And from there, it just kept going. And then we started doing residential retreats again from there. So there we go. I'm grateful for that experience. I don't regret it at all. And I'm grateful for the people who went through it with me and the ones who stuck around and the ones who didn't. I'm glad they left because it pushed me to do something else. I think probably I was able to do that out of love again.
Were you afraid that it wouldn't take off?
Yeah, I mean, I was completely discouraged, devastated. I felt like a total failure. In the meantime, my Dharma brother, Frank, was like having hundreds of people coming to this, all his activities in Belgium. And I was totally devastated. And I, total failure. Yeah.
Amy, can I just say something?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I don't know, this feels like when you hear your parents tell you how they met and then how you were born, you know? Hearing this story is so heartwarming because it's how this Sangha was born in a way and how we are together now here. So it's, thank you, Debbie, for having asked this question because, well, I've heard it before, but not in such a detail. And it was amazing. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. It is, it's very special. Yeah, Tiago?
Sorry, I just want to say thank you for not quitting.
Thank you. I couldn't quit, I don't think. Yeah, go ahead, Lisa.
No, it's just a thought that crossed my mind about love and how, and the seriousness of the forms and the practice, and how sometimes it's just hard to see the two together, how one leads to the other. If you look at the Japanese practice, it looks so formal and strict and just the forms, and to think that of that, or that the practice of that is love, is sometimes just weird. I don't know if you see what I mean, but.
Yeah, it makes no sense intellectually. No. And, you know, of course, what always happens with rituals and forms is they become something. They start out as a response to a situation, and from the heart, and then they become ritualized and they lose that. We tend to lose contact with them and just repeat them. You know, we see this in all organized religions. Christ's message was love. And yet, look at what has arisen from that. Some wonderful, fabulous things, but wow. You think of, like, you know, these really fundamentalist evangelical Christians in the U.S., they're not involved with love at all, you know, in some of their positions. Or even some of the rituals don't seem to be. So I hear what you're saying. But we can also look at it in a bigger context, that those Japanese forms were just a response to their context, because it came from China, where it was completely different forms and different context. And the Chinese forms came from India, which was something completely different. So the fact that it evolves according to the circumstances is manifestation that it's love, that it comes from love. It's 9 o'clock, so I think we should end here. I don't know what to do about the link for tomorrow morning. I also might specify that they said, if you want to do the sitting, it's an hour sitting from 8 to 9, you should log on a few minutes before 8, and they will open the Zendo and let you in. And then, but if you don't want to sit and you just want to come to the ceremony, you can't come at like 8:30 or something. They will let you in at 9 for the ceremony. Okay.
Maybe the only thing that you could do is write down these numbers, 8, 7, and so on. You just write down these numbers, or you do a screenshot of your screen.
It's really not possible to copy and paste. No.
Well, just write it down. It's just a couple of numbers.
Actually, I managed to open the link on my browser, so you can just click on the link and it stays there, so you can then copy paste it to someone else, somewhere else.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Okay, that works. Yeah.
Okay. It's great. 1 hour sitting, right?
Yes.
1 hour, okay.
Yeah. But, you know, you're in your own home, so you don't have to sit there the whole time. If you don't, you can get up and walk around or something. Yeah.
Oh, no, I just understood that it was 2 hours, but no, it's 1 hour. Yeah, okay.
From 8 to 9, and then the ceremony is at 9.
Okay, thank you.
Now, of course, for you in Portugal, that's early. That's 7 to 8.